Welcome to another edition of The Spirit Revolution. My name is Philip Coppens.
My name is Kathleen McGowan.
And our special guest tonight is Gavin Menzies. And it is an absolute pleasure to have him on for people who might be familiar with the name. He is the author of 2.5 international bestsellers, if not already by this moment in time, 3. 1421 and 1434 are books you've probably seen very prominently either in bookshops being displayed on special stands or on tables or on Amazon high-ranking lists. And a few weeks ago, he added a third one to the list of extraordinary books, and it's called The Lost Empire of Atlantis. So, Gavin, welcome to the show.
Well, thank you very much for inviting me, Philip and Kathleen. I'm much looking forward to it.
Thanks for being on our show. First of all, let's start where you began. You have a career as a, broadly speaking, a sailor, and
yes.
You became intrigued with basically traveling the seas in ancient times. And it
yes.
first took you to China, and really you opened up a completely unknown part of our world's history.
Well, it's very polite of you to say so, but all of my books have come about as a complete accident. In 1990, my wife and I decided we'd have a holiday in China. Our children were just about through their universities and so on. And we arrived in the Forbidden City in Beijing on a beautiful, cold New Year's Eve. And there were lots of exotic things going on, dragon dancers and fire eaters and so on. And at the end of the tour of the Forbidden City, I asked our guide, when was this Forbidden City built? And she said it was built in 1421. And the Emperor of China sent a huge fleet of ships all around the world to bring to Beijing emperors, princes, and kings for the inauguration of the Forbidden City. And this came as a great surprise to me. I had no idea that China had a navy 600 years ago that could sail the world. So when I got back to London, I thought I'd do a bit of research, and I researched what was going on in London at the same time as the Forbidden City was being inaugurated, and I found that it was a very eventful year in English history because Henry V, our great warrior king, had decided to bring the Hundred Years' War to an end. He would marry the French princess Catherine of Valois, and she was to be crowned in London at Westminster Abbey. At the same time as the Forbidden City was being inaugurated in Beijing. So I could make a direct comparison between what was going on in London and what was going on in Beijing in the same year and month of February 1421. And I found to my great surprise that China was a massively powerful and wealthy country all those years ago, and England was just a very small state. And to give an example, in the summer of 1421, the Chinese emperor sent a fleet of ships to Africa, 8,000 miles away. And the ships were enormous. They were supplied by water tankers and grain carriers, and he could put ashore an army of over 20,000 people. That same month, June 1421, Henry V had to ferry his little army across to France. He had 600 archers. And he didn't have any ships at all, so he had to commandeer fishing boats. So there was just a yawning disparity between China in 1421 and Europe, the rest of the world. And that was what my first book was called, 1421, The Year China Discovered America. Now, we were terribly lucky with our timing because just at the time the book was published, people were getting interested in China. And therefore, the book sold pretty well worldwide in over 100 countries in the end. And people just liked Chinese history and they were interested in what the Chinese had been up to and so on and so forth. So it was pure luck that the first book came out when it did.
But it went on to become a stunning international bestseller, and it was followed up by 1434, which is only 13 years later, but you uncovered another dimension to what was happening in 1434.
Well, yes. At the same time as 1421 was published, my publishers, Transworld, said, look, you've got to set up a website because you're going to get a lot of emails. So we did. and we had hundreds of thousands of emails over the years. And a consistent criticism of my book, 1421, has been from readers that I'd oversimplified the whole story, that, okay, the Chinese did discover the world and America before Columbus. They did sail the world before Magellan. They made maps which were of the whole world long before Europeans did. But they also did visit Europe, and I'd missed out a great slice of history. So 1434 aimed to correct that. It was a description of the fleet which the Chinese emperor sent to Europe to meet the Pope in 1434. And this fleet brought with it all sorts of valuable commodities, not least a world map showing the Americas. And the Pope instructed Toscanelli, his advisor and courtier, to make sure that copies of this map were sent to the King of Portugal, who was leading exploration in those days, and Christopher Columbus. So Columbus set sail with a Chinese copy of a Chinese map showing him the way to the Americas. That was the subject matter of 1434.
In the books, you basically show how this traveling across vast distances and oceans is quite commonplace, but before really Columbus enters the scene and starts official Western history of talking about these things and doing these things.
Yes.
Was it a revelation for you that, okay, 1421 is less than a century before Columbus, but was it a revelation for you that there was this unknown part of history, or were you quite aware of the fact or the possibility that this
was happening?
No, I
wasn't aware of it at all. I was absolutely amazed to find out that this was a completely unknown area of history. In fact, the first book that I wrote after visiting China back in 1990 was called just simply 1421. It wasn't called 1421, the year China discovered America, or 1421, the year China discovered the world. It's just straightforward 1421. And my agent, literary agent Luigi Bonomi, sold that book to a prestigious small publisher called Methuen. And Methuen wanted to have the book checked out by reputable historians. And they sent it out to 10 historians. And one of these came back and said, well, we've got a map in our library in Minneapolis, which was drawn up in 1421. And it shows what we think are islands in the Caribbean. Do you want to have a look? So I did. I went and had a look. And I could see these islands were Puerto Rico and Les Saintes and Guadalupe. Three islands, very well drawn, very accurately drawn. And I could say they were. It was those islands for sure, because I'd taken my submarine through the Caribbean and I'd taken periscope photographs of some of the islands. Well, realizing this map drawn in 1421 shows the Caribbean 70 years before Columbus gave me a hell of a jolt. I thought, well, this is just astounding. Columbus did not discover America. So I asked Methuen if they would release me from my contract if I paid the advances, which they very kindly did. And I had to start all over again with no publisher. My agent was pretty fed up. And my wife was, beginning to wonder why was I spending all these years on what appeared to be a mad goose chase. But we managed to find out a lot about Chinese voyages before Columbus, and in particular that the emperor of China had basically lost control of the country. He was a megalomaniac, Zhu Di, and he had decided he would rebuild the Forbidden City right on the borders of Mongolia, and he'd rebuild the Great Wall, and he'd rebuild his Forbidden City, and he'd build an enormous fleet of ships, huge ships, 10 times the size of Columbus's. And he'd do all this in 5 years. This is his plan. Well, he just about bankrupted China in the process of doing this, and the Mandarins decided they'd have to take over control from the Emperor Zhu Di, and they ordered that the records of all these voyages across the world were to be destroyed. And when the ships returned from their world voyages, they were to be laid up, and the captains and the crews were to be paid off. And that's what happened. So for a long time, it was forbidden to discuss Chinese voyages overseas. And in about 1430, I've forgotten the exact date, 1438 it was, it was punishable by death to trade overseas. So the Mandarins wanted to keep China absolutely clean and pure and get rid of the barbarian influence and not discuss what the great admiral Zheng He had found on his voyages between 1405 and 1434. So that was I was absolutely amazed to find out all that stuff, yeah.
Absolutely. And then you decided to once again go on holiday, which for us is a great pleasure, but maybe for your wife it wasn't, because you decided to go to Crete, home of the Minoan civilization.
Yes.
Now, the Minoan civilization is one of these civilizations, even people who are extremely interested in lost civilizations or ancient mysteries will quite often say, oh, well, you know, they're these people on this little island. And really it is a gigantic mistake to draw a conclusion like that, because they are extraordinarily important, and you have exploded their importance by basically analyzing their sea power.
Well, thank you. It was the latest book, The Lost Empire of Atlantis, once again was a complete fluke. I didn't set out to write a book about Atlantis at all. In fact, when I was young, Atlantis was synonymous with cranks and nutters and general loonies. What happened was I'd finished writing 1434, and I was incredibly tired. And Christmas 2008, Marcella and I thought we'd go to Crete for a holiday, and we'd live in a monastery, and we would drink plenty of vino and go for long walks and so on. And on one of these long walks, we got right down to the south coast of Crete, and there we found the most beautiful palace built of white marble. It was huge, absolutely enormous, stretched over the hillside overlooking the sea. And we spent a couple of hours going around this palace. And at the end of it all, we said, when was this palace built? And the guide said, it was built 4,500 years ago. And I said, well, this is ridiculous. It can't possibly be that old. And the guide said, well, it is. And I said, well, how can you tell? And he said, because in the pharaoh's tombs in Egypt, there are pictures of our ships leaving this palace at Phaistos in Crete, sailing to Egypt and presenting presents to the pharaohs. Now, the pharaohs have been very accurately dated, so it enabled people to say exactly when this palace of Phaistos was first built. Well, that absolutely amazed me, the thought that there were ships. It wasn't the Chinese who pioneered world voyages. There were people 2,000, 3,000 years before them. So I thought, well, if this is true, it's a really remarkable story. We must find out more. So we basically toured around the museums in Crete, and we did find pictures of these ships on pottery and on seals dating back to 3,000 BC. Well, this was an amazing revelation, and we were told we wouldn't find any wrecks or many artifacts from these ships, because the whole civilization in Crete, the Minoan civilization, had been wiped out in 1450 BC, that's 3,500 years ago, by a volcanic eruption which took place on an island called Santorini, which was 70 miles north of Crete. And this volcano in Santorini had exploded and sent cubic kilometers of muck into the air, which had landed in Crete, and it had destroyed the plants and given the livestock diseases and so on. And that had been followed by a huge tsunami which came from Santorini, thundered across the Mediterranean and smashed into the palaces and ships which were in harbors in northern Crete. So the whole Minoan civilization in Crete was wiped out by this catastrophic eruption and tsunami 3,500 years ago. So we thought, right, we'll go to Santorini and see if we can find anything there. So off we went. We got a ferry, went to Santorini. And we learned, to our great surprise and joy, that a group of Greek archaeologists had decided to try and find the capital of Santorini back in Minoan times in 1450 BC. And they'd selected the southern part of the island to do their digging. And they drilled down, and by pure luck, they arrived in the old capital place called Akwetiri in the island of Santorini. And even more amazing, they'd landed up in the palace of an admiral. Now, how did they know it was an admiral? Because around the walls of his palace, which had been buried in this 1450 BC volcano, there were paintings of a fleet of ships returning to Santorini from an unknown overseas destination. Now, the ships were obviously painted before the eruption, because the Admiral's Palace was buried by the eruption. So we can say for sure that the paintings of these ships are 3,500 years old or more. Now, the painting is incredibly explicit. You could see exactly how the ships were built, the hulls, shapes and sizes. You could see how many men were carried, 120 sailors on board. You could see how the sails were used, all the rigging that enabled the ships to sail into the wind or before the wind, and lower or alter the shape of their sails. Very, very sophisticated. So it was obvious to us that, completely unknown to most historians, Crete and Santorini possessed a really formidable deep-sea navy 3,500 years ago. So Columbus was actually about 3,000 years late. So we thought we'd try and find wrecks of these ships. And what we did is we asked the archaeologists, who were very, very helpful, and they said, well, three wrecks have been found off the coast of Turkey, about 200 miles east of Santorini and Crete. So we went there to a place called Bodrum, and there were three ships found on the bottom of the Mediterranean Sea. One was dated 1600 BC, that's 3,600 years old. Another 1,300 BC, 3,300 years old. And the third one, 1,100 years old. Now, these three ships, or at least two of them, had been carrying copper. And what had happened was the copper had reacted with the seawater to prevent weevils and worms attacking the hull. So the hull was in pretty good shape, despite having sat on the bottom of the Mediterranean for 3,500 years. Well, because there were large chunks of hull intact, it meant that the currents, the sea currents, couldn't wash away the cargo that was in these ships when they sank. And so the cargo has been brought up and put in a museum in Bodrum, where we went to. And astonishingly, the cargo came from six different civilizations. There was Indian elephant tusks. There was hippopotamus teeth from Africa. There was gold from Egypt, blue glass from Mesopotamia. Copper, which I'll come to in a moment, from an unknown source, and amber from the Baltic. Now, nobody disputes that this amber found in these wrecked ships did come from the Baltic, which is a long way from where they sank. It's over 3,000 miles away. So what we decided to do next was to go to all the places from whence the goods had got into been brought from these ships and see if there was corroborative evidence. So the first place we went to was the Baltic. And we found that a very distinguished man, a mathematician called, damn it, I've forgotten his name. Anyway, Hans Peter Dürer, He was at the time a director of the Max Planck Institute, and he had taken his family to where the amber came from, and they'd found that buried in the peat layer were huge Minoan vases which were used to store grain, and they were so big they couldn't have possibly been brought by horse or camel. They had to come by ship. And these storage tanks were carbon dated to 1450 BC, and they were definitely Minoan because their decorations and so on, and they had the Minoan Linear A language. Well, this confirmed that ships from Minoan Crete had reached the Baltic before 1450 BC, and they brought back amber, and they had traveled on the round trip about 3,500 miles. Well, this was about the same distance from Crete to America. So our next port of call was America. And we went there because we found that some of the copper ingots in these sunk ships was of incredible purity, 99% pure. And that was copper of that purity was only found, as Philip, you know, in the mines of the Great Lakes of America. So the book, or the first 31 chapters of the book, is about going around the world to find corroborative evidence that these ships had traded from North America across the Atlantic to the Mediterranean, across the Mediterranean to Egypt, and then to India. So that is really what the book's about.
And along the way, you really paint a completely different picture as to what the real history of these lost civilizations are, really, I think. I mean, a few highlights of that, and I think one of them, obviously, is Egypt. It was known that the Minoans made contact with the ancient Egyptians. They are briefly described as Keftiu, who seem to dash in and out of the country for a little while. But really, there is far more to it than that.
Well, that's quite right. There were very close relations between Minoans, who Plato called Atlanteans, as perhaps we'll come to shortly. But basically, the Minoans did have very close links with Mesopotamia and with Egypt. And they, for example, they were granted by the Egyptians a lease of a big naval base in the Nile Delta. So the Minoan ships could rest up in this base in the Nile Delta, and they could replenish their water and their fruit and vegetables and dried fish before they set off again to the east to India. The same could be said with Mesopotamia. There was an extensive and intensive trade between Minoan ships and Mesopotamian cities like Babylon and so on. So they had close contact with the leading civilizations of the time, and this enabled the Minoans to become very learned, because Mesopotamia and Egypt had obviously writing, and they had mathematics and astronomy. And my book describes how these contacts between the Minoans, the Babylonians, and the Egyptians enabled the Minoans to greatly improve their mathematics, astronomy, town planning, and so on. For example, they built four-story houses, the Minoans did, in Crete and in the Nile Delta. And these houses, which are 4,000 years old, had running water, they had hot and cold water, they had flushing toilets, they had alabaster roofs, which let in the light. And the rooms were spacious, they had marble floors, marble walls, and very elegant.
Absolutely. I mean, the Minoan civilization is beautiful. Anybody who ever needs to go to a place where you can do everything, whether it is sunbathing, mountain climbing, caving, all of these things, Crete really is the place to go.
Yeah.
And it's actually, when you were talking about the extraordinary eruption of Santorini,
yeah,
one of the northern palaces, Malia, there yes. is the seashore there, and I would invite anybody who is going to Crete to actually walk around the seaside there, because what you can see there is really how the volcanic ashes and everything else, rubble from this explosion, has really coated the seaside, and you can just see the extraordinary power of nature in this place, let alone yes. the fume of Santorini is said to have obscured daylight for I mean, there are speculations between days and months, but really, yes. You know, that it was an extraordinary event. Now, the Bronze Age required yes. copper and tin, and there are various stories about how Jesus' uncle, Joseph of Arimathea, was said to go to England for tin, and then there are various disputes as to whether or not this was happening in roughly 1 AD. But basically, yes. this tin trade between the Mediterranean and England is yes. thousands of years older.
You're quite right. Well, the copper, the ingredients for bronze, well, why is bronze important? First of all, because it's when you get the right mixture of copper and tin, it's fairly easy to make bronze, which is malleable and can be used to make extremely sharp saws. So with bronze saws, you can carve up planks to make ships, which gives a massive improvement in seagoing capacity. But because before, ships were built of planks, so built out of dugout logs. So before they had bronze saws, people could not really make seagoing ships. They could make logs with capacity for a few people in, which could sail in inland waters, but they couldn't possibly sail in the open ocean. So once the Minoans had bronze saws, they could have an ocean-going fleet. They can also, at the same time, arm the sailors in those ships with armor, defensive and offensive armor. They can make breastplates and helmets and swords and lances and spears and knives and so on. And they can also make useful things for fishing, hooks to catch fish, and they could make farming implements, hoes, scythes, sickles, spades, forks, and so on. So once you get bronze, you are in a commanding position to become the most powerful economic state in existence. Well, to get bronze, you need 88% copper and 12% tin. The copper in North America was not only of incredible purity, 99%, with very, very few trace elements or muck or dirt mixed in with it. So, secondly, it was also just lying on the surface around the Great Lakes. So you could literally just pick it up, and some of the copper nuggets were about 5,000 pounds in weight. So it was an absolute fantastic wealth just sitting in around the Great Lakes, ready to be picked up, of pure, pure copper. Now, the other place, where did tin come from? It came from southwest England in Cornwall. And again, in Cornwall, 4,000 years ago, tin of great purity was just lying on the surface. So once the Minoans collected the tin from Cornwall, southwest England, and the copper from the Great Lakes, they could make very high quality bronze, and basically that's what they did.
It really shows how this, you know, again, I quite often say that today we live in a global village whereby our furniture and everything else is made in China, our phone calls are answered in India.
Yeah.
But apart from the phone calls in India, very much the ancient world 5,000 years ago seems to have been a global village as well.
Absolutely. Now, this you can show very clearly because the implements which the miners of the Great Lakes left behind in their mines, all mining in the Great Lakes suddenly stopped about 1250 BC after the tsunami and after the volcanic eruption. That obviously killed the Minoan civilization. It killed the need for people to go to America, and the mining stopped. But today, what you have in museums around the Great Lakes, there are literally thousands of copper artifacts left behind by the miners. So what we did is we photographed, we got about 10,000 photographs, I think, of these artifacts, and we selected a couple of dozen. And we then went to the places the Minoans traded, like the Orkney Islands, southwest England for the tin, northwest France, southwest Spain, and then across the Mediterranean, including what was in the wrecks, and India and Egypt. And we found, either in museums or in old wrecked ships, that the implements found in the Great Lakes were just the same as the implements found in the wrecks sitting on the bottom of the Mediterranean off Bodrum. And there are a lot of photos in my book. I'd like to thank my author for allowing us so many, but there are pages and pages of photographs of implements comparing various what's found in the Great Lakes and what is found in the wrecks and other places that the Minoans traded. Now, I can illustrate this by razors. Minoan men disliked beards, and so did their womenfolk. So the men were clean-shaven, and they used bronze razors. And the design of these razors is common from the Great Lakes to England to Spain, France, across the Mediterranean, in Crete, in Santorini, in Egypt, the Nile Delta, and in India. So we, on our website, gavinmenzies.net, there are pictures of these razors. But that wasn't the only thing that was common to this trading empire. They had common weights and measures. They had common units of measurement. They had a common language, Linear A and Linear B, and it really was a unified trading empire created in about 2500 BC until it was wiped out by this horrific eruption and tsunami.
So basically 1,000 years of international trade, which is actually far longer than we are currently having this international trade at this moment in time. Now, something which you don't mention in the book, but which I just wanted to find out what your opinions are on it, or whether you did investigations on it, is this story which we have done on our show before, specifically with author Ralph Ellis, which is this notion that one of Akhenaten's daughters, when everything went south for Akhenaten's regime in Egypt, was somehow able to jump on a ship and via Spain reach the coasts of first Ireland and then Scotland, where she gave her name, i.e. Scotia, to the land of Scotland. Again, this is one of these stories which never goes away, but reading your book, it is absolutely possible. It is set within the realm of the possibility rather than the realm of the exception.
Well, before answering, if I could briefly explain an enormous stroke of luck I had. I sold literally worldwide rights to my book, Lost Empire of Atlantis, to Orion in last April 2010. And they issued a press release, which the Greek government picked up, and they asked me if I'd like to appear on a television show in Greece, which, of course, I accepted. And unknown to me, on this show, was Professor Minas Tsikritsis, who had spent 20 years and had actually managed to decrypt the Minoan language Linear A, and this has been the sort of holy grail of decryption specialists, and he managed to do it. So swathes of new evidence came through his translation. Now, he came to the conclusion that the Minoans had traveled all over the world, which he could tell by their Linear A script being found. And this, of course, was an incredibly interesting corroboration of what I'd found by a completely different route. Now, one of the things he was able to do was to describe the travels of Akhenaten's or Akhenaten's father's wife, a woman called Queen Tiyi, and she had a sort of royal procession through the Greek islands, which lasted over 3 months. It was very carefully documented where she would visit. So it's rather like Queen Elizabeth going to Australia. Tiyi went round the island. So I think it's entirely possible that Akhenaten's daughter did do what your guest said. If I could say that the really interesting thing to me is the description of the tsunami which hit the Nile Delta in 1450 BC, which is described, in my view, very accurately in the biblical book of Exodus. And so we can learn a huge amount of what happened in Egypt to Akhenaten, the causes of Akhenaten's misfortunes and his family life and so on, by reading Exodus. So I think your guest was probably quite right.
That's our opinion as well. Now, going back in time, so to speak, in the book, we have these Minoans. They are obviously on the island of Crete, but you've traced their origins, first of all, apparently back to Anatolia, and this is largely done through DNA analysis.
That's correct. How this came about was after I'd more or less finished the book, I learned that a group of very prestigious professors, Americans and Greeks, had found that Priveli Gorge in southern Crete, there was evidence that human beings had been living there for 100,000 years. Now, Greece is an island and has been an island for 5 million years. So if people lived on Crete had been living there for 100,000 years, it meant they must have sailed from the mainland to get to Crete. Well, I thought the most obvious place from whence they had come was Anatolia. So I went to Anatolia. I went around the cities on the Aegean coast as well as the Mediterranean coast. And I found there was plenty of evidence that man had actually lived in the cities on the coast for 100,000 or 200,000 years. So I then scouted around to try and find if there's any DNA evidence, and I found that there was. It's quite clear that the inhabitants of Greece originated in Anatolia. Now, the principal DNA report on which I have relied is by a Finnish group of professors led by Mary Riedler, and they have found the most astonishing to me, conclusion that the people of the Americas who have haplotype genetics A, B, C, and D, also those living around the Great Lakes, have a haplotype called X2. And haplotype X2 is found where the Minoans originated, that's Anatolia, where they settled, that's Crete and Santorini, where they traded, that's on islands across the Mediterranean, on the rivers of Spain, northwest France, southwest England, Orkney Islands, and the Great Lakes. The Ojibwa people who live there today have this X2 haplotypes. Now, X2 is not found anywhere else. It's not found in the East. It's not found in China. It's not found anywhere save where the Minoans originated, lived, and traded.
That kind of like brings us to the fact that the bull cult, which is very famous in Minoan times, it's kind of like their billboard. Anybody who has seen a depiction of Knossos will see that big bull's head. But you also find it on the Turkish coast, specifically Kartalhöyük. And then we really, thousands of years before the Minoan civilization in 7,000-8,000 BC.
You're absolutely right. The Minoans and the cult of the bull was one of their signatures. Now, these palaces Thaistos, Knossos, and so on. They had labyrinths underneath the palace where the bulls were kept. And they used to bring the bulls up for bull dance. The young men and young women was put in the ring with the bull, and they had to run straight at the bull, leap onto its horns, somersault on its back, and then jump off the back end of the bull. And this was this strange dance, very dangerous, but very, very beautiful when you see it in the mock-up, was found on seals, on paintings, on carvings, all across the Minoan Empire, not least in the fresco, which I described in Santorini. The painting around the walls of the Admiral's House shows bulls being led into Minoan ships, ready to sail away. And I think that the Spanish bullfighting is a direct legacy of the Minoans. Because if you look at some of the Spanish paintings of bullfights of long ago, particularly those of Goya in the Prado, you'll see that there was just the same leap over the horns of the bull onto his back and then leap off behind his hindquarters. So it's all, I think, a direct descendant of the bullfights which the Minoans carried out, the places where they traded, by carrying bulls from place to place in their ships.
Now, I was all prepared to ask you a question, and then you went and you mentioned the labyrinth. So I've got to back up and ask you to go back to the labyrinth and ask that, do you have any more thoughts on the purposes of the labyrinth? Do you feel that they were strictly a part of this bull aspect of the culture, or did you feel that there's something else going on with the labyrinth symbolism and with the constructed labyrinths?
Kathleen, I'm afraid to say I never really thought about it. I don't think that the story of the bull eating humans is true. That, as you know, there's a lot of stories that the Greeks had to provide to King Minos each year a group of young men and women who would be fed to this ravenous bull that lived in the labyrinth. As far as I can see, the Minoans are very, very peaceful people. They didn't put anyone to death, as far as I know, for fun. So that aspect of the labyrinth, to keep the monstrous bull, really fed with humans, I personally don't think it's true.
So at what point in all of this extraordinary research did you transition to this is Atlantis? And did that scare you? Were you afraid? Because at the beginning you did mention
yes.
that for a lot of people, this idea of Atlantis is the realm of the fringe and the nutters.
Yes,
and did you go ahead.
Kathleen, absolutely. My book was nothing to do with Atlantis to start with. And then after I'd written the book, my wife produced a book by Professor Galanopoulos, which gave a sort of potted history of Atlantis and why it had failed eventually. And I read it, and I was absolutely flabbergasted because I realized that what I'd been describing, the Minoans, and I'll give you a few examples if I may, in fact, I was describing people who Plato called the Atlanteans. Now, Plato described a very wealthy society which lived on two islands. One island was circular, 12 miles across, which is exactly what Santorini is. One was rectangular, much, much larger, which Crete is. And that the people on these two islands made their money from trading metal, particularly bronze, which, of course, the Minoans did. Now, at the time when Plato was describing Atlantis, the only island in the world which traded metal were Crete and Santorini. Other places traded metal, Mesopotamia and Egypt, but they weren't islands. Furthermore, Plato says the people were literate. They had a language, which, of course, the Minoans did, and that the Big Island was famous for crops, fruit and corn, and perfume. It exported perfume in big quantities, which, again, that is exactly what Crete did. Plato says that this very sophisticated people were, to start with, peace-loving, which the Minoans were. They didn't want to hurt anyone. But through greed and avarice, they decided they would sail from a continent, the other side of the Atlantic. I say that continent, the other side of the Atlantic, can only be America. They sailed across the Atlantic, and they decided to attack Greece. That's, of course, what the Minoans did. And then the gods became furious with the Minoan civilization, and they decided to destroy it. So in one night and one day, they destroyed the whole civilization. And that's exactly what happened to Crete and Santorini. This horrific volcanic eruption ended the civilization in one day and one night. So I say that everything that is in my book about the Minoans is corroborated and explained by Plato's description of Atlantis and its tragic end.
Now, the Big A is an extremely controversial subject, and I know the book has only been out a few weeks, but
yes.
what is the feedback on this? Like, because the book, even though it's not word count wise half and half, and part of the book is to do with the ancient global trade,
yes.
and the final aspect is with Atlantis, but there are
yes.
two aspects to this book. What is the feedback, or is the Big A bringing out difficulty in people accepting the first part, or kind of, in essence, what is the feedback?
Yes, well, I quite understand the question. Could I say it was a terrific toss up whether we had Atlantis in the title or not? A lot of distinguished emeritus professors in America said, for heaven's sake, don't have the word Atlantis in your title, because that will put a lot of people off. Well, we thought about it long and hard, and I thought, well, this is the truth. I mean, I've got to put it in. So we went ahead and put Atlantis in the title. Now, I should say that, in my opinion, for what it's worth, reviews, good reviews and bad reviews, don't really count for an awful lot. For example, a really terrible review, which I've had from ABC of Australia. A television program was set up by ABC of Australia, and they basically ripped my book, 1434 and 1421, to pieces. And they said that my publishers were and I were crooks, and we invented things and produced fake maps, etc., etc. Now, that led to trebling of sales in Australia. My book in Australia became the best selling history book. And the other side of the coin, we've had some very, very good reviews. For example, Japanese television program about my book, 1421, Chinese books, television programs about 1421 and 1434. And they haven't affected sales at all. So I wasn't all that worried about whether sales would be beefed up or collapse by putting the word Atlantis in the title. But I was worried about what the academics would think. And we've had tremendous support from academics for the lost empire of Atlantis. We've five emeritus professors have supported what's in the book. That's Emeritus Professor John Sorensen, Emeritus Professor Carl Johannesson, Emeritus Professor John Coughlin, Emeritus Professor Betty Meggers, and Emeritus Professor Carol Riley, all have said they think the substance of the story is true, but they have added the rider that Minoans were not the first to undertake ocean-going trade long ago. There were people who came before them, and I agree with that, incidentally. So, and we've had on Amazon six reviews, five-star reviews, and we've had hundreds and hundreds of emails in support. So I'm very surprised and pleased with the reaction of academics. But as I said, it doesn't necessarily mean book sells well with good reviews. Often it sells well with bad reviews.
And that is good to know as well. You just hinted at the fact that the Minoans weren't the first, and you have been pushing back the date of transoceanic contact step by step. So
yes.
Where are you going next? Is it going to be linked with another holiday, or have you got a firm plan as to what the next step is going to be?
Well, I'm very interested in the descriptions in Exodus, the book of Exodus, which, in my view, is describing the tsunami, which, as it roared across the Mediterranean from Santorini and smashed into the Nile Delta and basically finished Akhenaten and created havoc. And the end of Exodus describes some extraordinary terrestrial events. And for the moment, all I think I'd like to say is that I think that they are true. And what Exodus describes is actually correct. But I'm afraid you have to wait till I do a bit more research.
Absolutely, and it'll be a hard wait, but we will do it. Now, when I look at a map of the world, I see China going to Africa, to Europe,
yes.
Europe going to America. The odd one out so far seems to be Australia. Have you got any hints as to whether Australia was part of this global program, or do you think at this moment in time it is the odd one out?
Well, Philip, funny enough, we've had, as you say, we've had lots and lots of emails that the Minoans got to Australia in 1500 BC. Or before. Now, the thing is that, as far as I know, that is not substantiated by DNA research. It might be because there hasn't been any DNA research on Australian Aboriginal people. But in my book, there's a picture of where X2 haplotype is found amongst peoples, as I described, from the Great Lakes, right the way across the Mediterranean to Egypt, and so on. So I can't buttress. I reckon I'm on absolutely solid ground with what I put in this book because of the DNA evidence. DNA doesn't lie, and that's what happened. But if I started writing about Australia, I can't substantiate it with DNA.
You have been doing this for a number of years. You have, I think, you know, created a movement. I can see that on the internet. I can also see it in the fact that ABC Australia does these campaigns against what you bring out.
Yes.
So what are you happy with? What, first of all, did you expect it to happen? And specifically, what kind of need do you see people you fill in a gap, something which people are hungering for, and what is that?
Well, from the positive side, I think I greatly admire publishers. I've had three publishers, and critics have been frenetic in their abuse about me and my books, and the publishers have, by and large, stayed rock solid and said, you know, stuff the critics, this is what we believe in. So I'm hugely impressed with publishers. I'm pretty dismayed with certain high-level academics who seem to be intent on safeguarding their little patch and furiously defending it against any novel or new ideas at all. And I think that historians in particular, the way that they treat peer review to safeguard their own little empire is actually a very serious setback to discovering true history. I mean, if you take Columbus, who was a very clever man, a great mathematician, I admire many of his qualities, but he sailed to America with a copy of a Chinese map. So how can you say that in 1492, his first voyage, he had a copy of a Chinese map that showed him the way, which he accepts. And the map's been found, and the letters from the Pope and Toscanelli have been found in his effects. Not only did he have a map, so he obviously didn't discover America, but he also had a contract in his pocket with the King Ferdinand of Spain, and he was going to be viceroy of the lands across the ocean, which we now know as America, on behalf of the Spanish crown. So, again, if you're sailing to be viceroy of a country which is shown on maps, how can you be said to have discovered the place? So there are still people, still scholars, so in inverted commas, who maintain Columbus discovered America when it's perfectly obvious he did no such thing.
Absolutely. And unfortunately, we have sailed to the sunset of this episode of The Spirit Revolution. Gavin, when you were talking about the fact that peer review is something which is really a tool of the Inquisition, I think, which is kind of like, you know, to keep a scientific dogma in place. If you or any of our listeners want to go to our archives, they will see or hear us rather rave about how peer review is really an instrument of the devil, and that, you know, this is not unique when it comes to transoceanic contact, but really that it is something which keeps an old paradigm in place, and really stops people from completely accepting new ideas and expanding our vision of history and what our ancestors were capable of doing. So, Gavin, we say this quite often, but that is because of all our guests we have here. You are an absolute spirit revolutionary. You really are pushing every day to make the entire human race understand that history is not the way it is, that it is far richer and far more interesting than we are quite often led to believe. So I hope you and your wife, Marcella, continue on this path for many more years to come, whether it is by design or by accidental holiday planning. For now, we are setting off in a new year, so I want to wish all our listeners a very prosperous 2012, and of course, Gavin, you, your wife, and your family as well. We sign off by continuously saying that if you want to listen to this episode of The Spirit Revolution again, you can do so in a number of ways. You can go to the BBS Radio Archives, where you can, for a small fee, listen to this recording, as well as hundreds of other recordings of shows which are airing on the BBS Radio Archive. You can go to thespiritrevolution.com, where you can see a listing of 2 years of this radio show's guests. The last five episodes are available online, and then if you go on iTunes, you can go into the podcast section and you will be able to download a year and a half's worth of our interviews absolutely for free. A very merry, happy 2012, Gavin, being you know, a wonderful conclusion to, I think, a wonderful year. But in 2012, our cry will be just as it was in 2011 and 2010.
The truth against the world.